Big news, everyone. We just released two new training programs. First up, our second generation Strength One program, which is designed for folks who are trying to get stronger on the squat, the bench press, the deadlift, and the overhead press. It includes four 12-week programs, and users can now pick their own exercises, choose between 3 or 4 day options, and choose to focus on either the bench press or the overhead press, in addition to the squat and the deadlift. The programming has also been overhauled to drive better results based on testing and user feedback. Next, we also launched our second generation Time Crunch program, which is designed for busy professionals, parents, and other on-the-go lifters who want to maximize results without spending hours upon hours in the gym. This one includes six 12-week programs, ranging from longer workouts that are performed 2 days per week to shorter workouts performed daily and everything in between. No matter what your availability is, we have something for you. Both programs can be done with basic gym equipment like a bar, rack, and weights, but they can also be modified to use more specialized equipment in the gym if you like. Both programs also include a brand new ebook that includes details on the program, training theory, nutrition, supplements, and more. If you previously purchased the first generation of these programs, check your email for instructions on how to upgrade to the latest version. For everyone else who wants to get the most out of their training, head over to barbellmedicine.com and check out these new training programs. Hey everyone, Jordan here from Barbell Medicine. I'll get to the podcast here in just a moment, but I wanted to take a second to plug our Barbell Medicine Plus option in order to help support what we do here on the podcast and beyond. Now, if you hate these ads just as much as we do, you should know that Plus members get ad-free episodes, as well as early access to our podcast, written episode summaries, videos, exclusive training information, access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing here and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus to help us out and get rid of these ads for good. Thanks for your support. Let's head to the podcast. Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, and this is our February 2025 research review, which is exactly what it sounds like. We're reviewing recent research that's been published in the health and fitness space and communicating it to you guys. Also, we've got a Quack Watch segment. And of course, we have the second most handsome doctor in North America on the other end of the line, Dr. Austin Baraki. What's going on, man?
Hey, doing all right. Standard hospital week going on at the moment. Have some interesting cases. Did some teaching this morning. And just last week, I got back from a pretty big trip. Spent about 9 days in Japan, which was pretty awesome experience. Very unique place. My first time going there. So that was great.
Did you meet Mr. Roboto? True or false?
Can't say that I did.
You can't say that you didn't either. What's the sushi like in Japan? That's I really asking for a friend.
Yeah, I mean, it was top notch. The sushi, the ramen, you know, you can find it. It is really a remarkable culinary city in Tokyo in particular. You can find anything you want there. So would recommend going there for sure.
You're really ruining this for me. I still have, you know, sour grapes about Tokyo 2020, the Olympics, because I'm planning on going. And honestly, yeah, I want to go see the Olympics. That would be fun for me as like a, you know, I'm not really a jock sniffer, but, you know, I'm sports adjacent and sports curious. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I thought, look, I'll be there for a week. How much sushi could one man eat? And I was going to find out if the upper limit, in fact, did exist. And I thought it would be like one of those pigeons at like a wedding, you know, that eats the instant rice and then like explodes. Like that's what I was hoping for myself. Unfortunately, did not get to do that. So, yeah, sushi by proxy. That's
another
what I'm getting
time
here from.
Would recommend for sure if you can swing it.
All right. Well, Dr. Baraki, did you know that February is American Heart Month? Were you aware?
No, I'm not sure that the heart necessarily needs an awareness month, but you're surprising me here.
Yeah. Well, like I went down the rabbit hole just to see like, are there other, like do other organs get months,
sure,
you know, like specific? It turns out like actually the heart, like February being American Heart Month, is one of the only months that has a very specific singular organ or you know, attached to it. Obviously, there are other certain medical conditions and such that have their own months. But yeah, so we've got some heart stuff we're going to talk about. and then we've got running injuries we're going to discuss, a new study that was sponsored by Garmin. They actually pulled, you know, a ton of records from users that had their one of their smartwatches and tracked all their runs. But first, we're bringing it back, one of our favorite segments, one of the listeners' favorite segments, Quack Watch. Now, I know that you've listened to this before, and I'll give you an opportunity to re-listen. But for our listeners at home, this is from a Dr. Courtney Hunt. And this is one of the people who puts doctor in their Instagram handle, who is, in fact, a physician. So this particular statement or series of statements and claims may be surprising to you. Let's listen.
I'm a doctor. Don't try this at home. So if you take testosterone injections or testosterone pellets and you put it on a man or a woman who is insulin resistant, it will cause them to not make as much muscle and distribute more fat in their belly, increasing their visceral fat, increasing their risk for heart attack, increasing their risk for dementia, increasing their risk for fatty liver, increasing their risk for vision problems. Testosterone, injections, pellets, creams, lozenges, any way you guys take it, in a person who's leptin and insulin resistant, even causes man boobs.
Okay.
Yeah, so just to rehash what Dr. Hunt said and who she is. So Dr. Hunt says that she's a medical expert in quantum biology who studies how DNA interacts with the environment and lifestyle. That sentence actually doesn't make any sense, but that's from her own website. She is also a leader, apparently, in the fields of mitochondrial health, nutrigenic medicine, which is another nonsensical term, and hormonal health. She also wrote a book called Your Spark is Light, The Quantum Mechanics of Human Creation. She's an OBGYN.
Not a physicist or a biologist or any way appropriate to be throwing these terms around.
Don't know what her quantum mechanics background is. Unclear, how much training she has in, mitochondrial health to the extent that should be its own separate field. But in any case.
It really reminds me of, I don't know if you're familiar, or if any, I probably even referenced this before, the Wisdom of Chopra website before, Deepak Chopra, random, quote generator. And that's just the website. I think it's just like wisdomofchopra.com. You go and it'll automatically generate some nonsensical metaphysical gibberish like this. And that's kind of what this subtitle reminded me of from her book.
Yeah, a medical expert in quantum biology. That's next level. Anyway, she's an OBGYN. And again, just to rehash her claims specifically, she says that taking testosterone in any form, man or woman, if the individual has insulin resistance, not only does not produce muscle gain, but also produces an increase in visceral fat, so belly fat, increases risk of heart attack, increases risk of dementia, fatty liver, vision problems, and even gynecomastia or man boobs, as she says. Also, if you didn't watch the video, I've linked the actual Instagram post in the description. Kind of a scary video to watch, not because of the imagery or whatever, just her with the subcutaneous needle just pointing it at you aggressively. Hey, this is so interesting. Someone actually responded in the comments, and I quote, "I would love to know the randomized controlled studies done on this." Pretty nice request as far as internet interactions go. And Dr. Hunt says, "Just study insulin resistance and testosterone. It's all on PubMed."
Hell yeah.
Okay. So to PubMed we go. Just before we get into kind of what the actual data says, this part of QuackWatch, I sent this to you maybe a couple of days ago, and your initial response was, legitimately, all of this is wrong. It's the exact opposite. So before we cover the data, how do you think she gets to this point? If true that all of the data is in opposition to what she says, how does this come about, in your opinion?
Yeah, not entirely sure. There might be some quantum mechanics going on in her brain that leads her to this conclusion. I will try to, as they say, steel man and be as charitable as possible to view this in a way that could be correct. And the one way that I can do that is that androgens, testosterone in particular, that we're talking about here, does have what we call differential effects on metabolic function, like visceral fat, insulin resistance, all these other kind of things, between men and women. And so when we look at cross-sectional data, for example, correlations between risk of diabetes and blood testosterone levels in men tends to be more the low testosterone deficiency that associates more strongly with metabolic issues like diabetes, insulin resistance, et cetera. Whereas in women in general, it tends to be higher levels of these androgens like testosterone, because yes, testosterone is synthesized in both men and women just by 10 to 20x, like, you know, fold difference between them. But a classic example of this is in polycystic ovarian syndrome, where women tend to have one of the cardinal features is hyperandrogenism, or excess levels of androgens to include testosterone among others. And that's a condition that often, not always, but often is associated with insulin resistance and things like that. And so if she were restricting her claims to say that testosterone or increasing testosterone or administering testosterone to women with insulin resistance can have detrimental effects on insulin resistance and things like that, it's like, okay, I can see a way that you could get there, even though I'm not aware of anyone who's necessarily proposing or recommending that within the reasonable realm outside of like ultra fringe, you know, hormone clinics and things like that. But she did not restrict it to that population. She's most of her claims, and including she followed up on it in the comments, was clarifying that she's mainly talking about in men. And in men is where this is like definitively 100% opposite of what she is claiming, as evidenced by a bunch of trial data that you have, that we've discussed and that I think you're going to go over here shortly.
Yeah. Yeah. Had she said like, hey, taking exogenous, so outside the body, testosterone in women with PCOS, so polycystic ovarian syndrome,
right,
that we suspect is caused by insulin resistance is probably not a great treatment option.
Yeah.
We'd be like, yes, but also who is recommending that? Like what? Anyway. Okay. So let's get into some real data. Cause again, it's all on PubMed. By the, you know, Dr. Hunt's own admission. So let's take a look here. So first off, obesity itself increases the risk of hypogonadism or low testosterone by about 13-fold in men in a dose-dependent manner, right? And the reason why I'm bringing up obesity, you're like, I thought we were talking about insulin resistance. If you look at like what is the most proximate cause for most insulin resistance, it's usually by carrying too much body fat, particularly in the United States and again, particularly in men. So in this study, effects of testosterone treatment on body fat and lean mass in obese men on a hypocaloric diet, this is a randomized controlled trial, researchers found that men with obesity and hypogonadism, so low testosterone and too much body fat, who were treated with testosterone replacement therapy, or TRT, and a calorie-restricted diet for 10 weeks, and that was followed by a maintenance diet phase for about a year, well, they were able to gain 3.3 kilograms of lean mass during the maintenance phase, compared to the controls who did not receive testosterone, so they got a placebo, who did not gain lean mass on average. So the first claim that, oh, it doesn't increase lean mass. Again, you would assume that most individuals with obesity have some level of insulin resistance, very, very common, and sure as shit, they can, in fact, gain lean mass. So right off there, first claim rejected based on evidence. A second study, again, just to keep going down these claims here, is from 2020. They took 350 men who had low testosterone, so hypogonadism, and type 2 diabetes. In this particular group, the average fasting blood sugar was 160, whereas a normal fasting blood sugar would be less than 100, and the diagnostic cutoff for type 2 diabetes from a fasting blood sugar is, if it's greater than 126. So in any case, this group of men were prescribed testosterone replacement therapy, and then compared to men with hypogonadism and type 2 diabetes, but who were not receiving testosterone. They followed them for 11 years. And to be clear, type 2 diabetes is like the definitive endpoint of insulin resistance. So there's no question whether or not these individuals are insulin resistant or not. They certainly are. The average A1C, which is a measurement of what your average blood sugar is over about 3 months in this group, was 9.4%, and a healthy level, normal level, is less than 5.7%. So again,
9.4% is very high. It's, you know, for people who work in acute care medicine like me, you know, we don't necessarily like freak out at that because we've seen 14, 15, 16, 18, but those are people who are just like in horrific shape. But for somebody who's an outpatient who's not actively admitted to the hospital, an A1C of 9.4% is bad.
Yeah, not low for sure. The average weight loss in the group receiving testosterone was 22.1 kilograms compared to gaining almost 7 kilograms in the group receiving no testosterone. The average waist circumference decrease. So this is a measurement of visceral fat or belly fat. It was down 13.3 centimeters in the group receiving testosterone and up 6 centimeters on average in the group not receiving testosterone. Insulin dose decreased by about 26 units in the group receiving testosterone. It went up about 20 units in the group not receiving testosterone. Other things like blood lipids, blood pressure, resting heart rate, inflammatory markers, etc., all improved in the group receiving testosterone compared to the group not receiving testosterone. And so, like, if we were just trying to address the claim, oh, giving individuals with insulin resistance testosterone increases their visceral fat. No, it doesn't. Prevents weight loss. No, it doesn't. Has some other sort of deleterious effect that we can somehow measure with, you know, standard, you know, clinical analytics. Seems like that's way off base. So again, your initial response was testosterone literally does the exact what she's claiming seems to be well supported here.
I agree. Everything tends to, you know, improve from an insulin resistance standpoint in this. And this is, again, you've pulled two trials, and these are not the only two. There are others, both randomized data, prospective cohort data, things like that. So it continues to baffle me where she came to this conclusion, in particular as it relates to insulin resistant men.
Yeah. Yeah. And it gets worse. Like, as you keep going through more and more studies in this T4DM trial, this is a randomized, double blind, placebo controlled 2-year study done in Australia in men with prediabetes, excess adiposity, so obesity, and testosterone less than 400 nanograms per deciliter, but no clinical hypogonadism. So these are men with definitive, again, insulin resistance, but they don't quite yet have type 2 diabetes. And so they were, the researchers, one of the outcomes they measured was, well, on average, how many of them progress to type 2 diabetes over the next 2 years? Those receiving testosterone replacement therapy, TRT, plus lifestyle modifications, they reduce the risk of progression to type 2 diabetes by 10% compared to lifestyle change alone, which, again, if she were right, you would not see this sort of stuff reflected in the data. And as you pointed out, this is just one of many studies that have a similar sort of setup that show the exact same thing. She goes on and says, oh, it increases risk of heart disease or heart attacks. Okay, let's, again, look at the data. Another study on men with prediabetes, again, insulin resistance, receiving testosterone replacement therapy versus controls. Over the next 8 years of follow-up, 0.8% of the men on TRT had non-fatal heart attacks, whereas 5.7% of those not receiving TRT had a non-fatal heart attack. So, again, I'm unclear as to, like, why this was the line in the sand that she decided to draw. Like, just pick a different topic that maybe there's no data out there, or at least maybe some of the data would be supporting, but it's like, it's not April yet. This is like an April Fool's post to me. it got a little interesting to me, and you can comment on this because I know you've been further into the weeds than I have on this. So regarding dementia, we don't really know that giving people testosterone replacement therapy or TRT, like, actually prevents dementia. We know that it reduces the risk factors that are strongly linked to developing dementia. One of the primary ones, particularly in developed countries, is type 2 diabetes. But to date, large long-term trials of testosterone replacement therapy show no increased risk, but maybe a little benefit on cognition. We just don't know if it actually reduces the, like, sort of progression to full-on dementia. And there's some studies I linked in the description on this. But with respect to her claim that, you know, giving people insulin resistance, type 2, giving them TRT, that increases the risk of dementia, like, where do you stand on that?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any signal that is reliable for that in the evidence on this topic. I agree that, you know, there are a lot of claims made around testosterone as it relates to cognition, and this has been studied a bit. It was one of the, you know, there was the, I think it was in 2017, the so-called testosterone trials, and there have been others. And these basically, like, took, you know, men middle to older age who had testosterone deficiency, who, you know, and they were put on testosterone and evaluated for various outcomes. Some of the metabolic stuff, the cardiovascular stuff, prostate related outcomes, some of these cognitive quality of life, all sorts of things. And yeah, although we haven't seen a dramatic improvement in their outcomes as it relates to cognition, in the same way that we see, like, significant improvements in insulin resistance and things like that. We certainly haven't seen a clear increase in risk of the development of dementia. That would be a pretty alarming finding. And so I choose to, you know, reject that claim as well for now, based on the current evidence. The caveat, I don't know that this is really a caveat, but the part of the issue that I could envision is that dementia is not one thing. Right. So if we're talking about the risk of somebody having a heart attack, like a heart attack is a relatively narrow kind of diagnosis. There are, I guess, a couple different ways that you can have a heart attack, but fundamentally, like overwhelmingly, you know, in the population, it's atherosclerotic related coronary disease. There are obviously, you know, fringe reasons why you can have a heart attack, but overwhelmingly atherosclerotic related. So when we see an intervention that increases or decreases the risk of heart attack, by and large, you know, for most of the time, it's going to be due to its impact on those kind of atherosclerotic risk factors, risk of thrombosis, clotting your coronaries, and things like that. Dementia is a different ballgame, similar to if you look at things and their impact on just like risk of quote unquote cancer. It's like, there's a lot of cancers out there, and some may be more or less amenable to your lifestyle, your behaviors, things that you do, whereas others are just like, well, you got an unfortunate genetic mutation, and that's going to set you up for this cancer regardless of what you do in your life. Similarly, with respect to dementia, cognitive impairment of any kind, be it related to Alzheimer's disease or other neurodegenerative conditions or vascular dementia or, you know, various other ones that may be more or less impacted by certain things. And so the more things you lump into your outcome, the less likely you are to actually detect a signal if one actually exists. And so that's one of the potential limitations here. But if I'm recommending somebody start testosterone therapy, we're not really having a conversation around like, well, you know, informed consent, you ought to know that this is increasing your risk of cognitive problems. It's certainly not. If anything, you know, some patients just anecdotally who may be experiencing some cognitive symptoms may report subjectively that they feel better, even though even that is not terribly well supported in quality evidence. It's more of a probably a bit more of an expectancy placebo type effect for some. And then others, there might be a biological mechanism that we haven't fully elucidated yet. But I'm not worried about increasing risk of dementia in people by initiating testosterone therapy on them when it's appropriate to do so.
Yeah. Yep. I agree. So, Dr. Courtney Hunt, thank you for the Quack Watch material. You definitively earned the award Quack for all of this. Let's summarize some of these findings here. So in men with insulin resistance who are otherwise good candidates for testosterone replacement therapy or TRT, administration of TRT definitively increases lean muscle mass preservation during periods of weight loss. It increases lean mass gain during periods of weight maintenance. It increases fat loss during periods of weight loss and maintenance. It improves insulin resistance as measured by fasting blood sugar, hemoglobin A1C, medication use requirements, and so on. It reduces the risk of progression from prediabetes to type 2 diabetes. It reduces risk factors for heart disease like dyslipidemia, so abnormalities in people's cholesterol levels, blood pressure, blood sugar, etc., and also seems to reduce the incidence of serious cardiac outcomes. It reduces risk factors for dementia with possible improvement in cognition in those with obesity, though it's unclear the size of the effect and the reliability of benefit across different populations. So when appropriately prescribed and monitored, TRT appears to be safe and beneficial for those with insulin resistance based on available evidence. And we should all be skeptical of talking head videos on social media that are making bold claims without supporting evidence, especially when they're pointing a syringe at you on camera. Excellent. Austin with the comedic relief here. Hi, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, founder of Barbell Medicine. And over the last 10 plus years in business, we've built a team of amazing professionals that includes physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, and strength coaches that are available to help you reach your goals. Whether it's strength and muscle gain, weight management, or recovering from an injury, we have some of the best coaches in the game and have worked with people from all walks of life. From teens to grandparents and beginners to elite level athletes, our experienced team of professionals work together to meet you where you're at and give you what you need to succeed. That's the Barbell Medicine difference. If you're not sure exactly what you need, take the quiz linked in the description below or send us an email, support@barbellmedicine.com, and we'll get you sorted. From all of us here at Barbell Medicine, we look forward to hearing from you. We'd love to help. This podcast is sponsored by Factor. While we all know that nutrition is huge when it comes to health and performance, we don't always have time to shop and prepare healthy meals. If you're ready to take your nutrition to the next level, let Factor help you take the stress out of eating healthy so that you can hit your goals. Skip the grocery stores, the prep work, and the cooking fatigue, and instead, you can get fresh, chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals delivered right to your door. Factor lets you choose from a ton of different meal plans, including 40 options across 8 different dietary patterns. When things get hectic, Factor is flexible. Change your order up every week with plans from 4 to 18 meals per week, or pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. And check this out. Factor is cheaper than fast food or dining out. Reach your goals this year with ingredients you can trust and convenience that can't be beat. If you want a helping hand with your nutrition, head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off. This episode is sponsored by Acorns. Last year, Save More Money was the most popular New Year's resolution in America. Now, clearly, a lot of us feel like our money is slipping through our fingers, and it's a good thing there's Acorns. Acorns hopes to grow your money into more of your money. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing so your money has a chance to grow for you, your kids, and your retirement. You don't need to be an expert. Acorns will recommend a diversified portfolio that fits you and your money goals. You also don't need to be rich, and you don't need a ton of time. Acorns lets you invest with the spare money you've got right now, as little as $5, and start investing in just 5 minutes. Basically, Acorns does the hard part so you can give your money a chance to grow. Now, financial stress can certainly play a big role in health, and Acorns gives you small, simple steps to get you and your financial wellness on track. Head to acorns.com/BBM or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. This is a paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/BBM. When you're trapped in a cycle of stressful, unwanted thoughts and repetitive behaviors that are taking over your life. That's how it can feel for individuals with obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, which is so much more than the stereotypes about liking things clean and organized. It's a seriously and highly misunderstood condition with two main symptoms: intrusive thoughts and compulsions that cause anxiety or distress. The intrusive thoughts are unwanted thoughts that feel disturbing, stressful, and totally out of character. They can be about anything, but often focus on people or things that we care about, making them hard to ignore. People with OCD often feel like they have to do something to relieve the anxiety from those thoughts. So they'll engage in compulsions, which are repetitive physical or mental behaviors like checking, asking for assurance, following strict routines, or mentally reviewing things over and over. Because there are so many misconceptions, a lot of people don't know that they have it, and they feel shame about their symptoms and suffer in silence. Plus, not every therapist understands OCD or is qualified to treat it effectively, which can make it difficult to find the right help. I can't stress enough how important it is to get the right kind of care, because just like a great workout program can transform your body, the right mental health care can transform your mind, and ultimately, the individual's life. OCD is highly treatable with a specialized type of therapy called ERP, or exposure and response prevention. With NoCD, you can do live, virtual ERP therapy with licensed therapists who specialize in ERP and OCD, so they can truly understand what you're going through, even the symptoms that feel hard to talk about. NoCD makes this life-changing treatment affordable and accepts more than 60 insurance plans, enabling over 155 million Americans to access evidence-based treatment at NoCD covered by insurance. And between therapy sessions, you'll have NoCD's powerful in-app support. If you or someone you love is struggling with OCD, you're not alone, and with the right care, you can get better. To find out more about therapy with NoCD, go to nocd.com and book a free 15-minute call with their team. That's nocd.com to learn more and book a free call. All right. Well, let's get into the February 2025 research review. Two new papers on deck. One is about the effect of different levels of calorie restriction on cholesterol lowering, and the other is on running injuries. If you guys are also curious about different studies that I read on a daily basis, one of my quote morning routine things. I skip the sunning my yoni part. I skip the coffee enema. I skip the journaling and the meditation in the dark and my infrared sauna. And I just go straight to PubMed. I have a handful of alerts that I have like set up for various keywords that I'm interested in. And I'll read a paper. That's my morning routine. And then if I have a little bit of extra time, I typically summarize it on the Barbell Medicine Forum under the general discussion tab. So you can see some of the stuff I'm reading, my thoughts on it, and kind of how I fold it into my existing knowledge. So if you're interested in that, check it out. If not, feel free to like just, you know, neuralize yourself from the last 20 seconds of me explaining my morning routine. So the first paper that we're talking about here is called Optimal Calorie Restriction Threshold, Effect of Fat Max Exercise Combined with Different Proportions of Calorie Restriction on Hypercholesterolemia. This is by Wu et al., published in Frontiers in Exercise Physiology, January 2025. And the purpose of this study was to see if there was an optimal range of calorie restriction for enhancing blood lipid profiles in those with high cholesterol. That's a fancy way of saying like, hey, look, is it better to do like maximum amount of calorie restriction or some like specific amount of calorie restriction to get the biggest bang for your buck with respect to improving your blood lipid levels. So let's do some little background stuff here. So there's been a steady decline in the mortality rate from heart disease in the U.S. Over the last four decades. Since 2015, however, there has been a flattening of the curve as multiple risk factors for heart disease have been on the rise. The established risk factors for heart disease include high blood pressure, diabetes, and blood cholesterol levels, among a few other ones we've discussed, like smoking, for example. Each of these risk factors increase the risk of heart disease with increased exposure, where exposure is related to both the severity and the duration of the particular risk factor. In other words, the higher someone's blood pressure, their blood sugar, or blood cholesterol levels, and the longer that they're elevated for, the greater the increased risk of heart disease is. So you'd prefer to catch these things early and keep them lower for longer. That would be like the sort of optimal biohacking trajectory if you were going to use some popular parlance. All right, Austin, I'm going to let you explain to people what lipids are, because I think when we say cholesterol and lipids, some people can get a little bit confused. And it's really not that confusing. It's not that complicated, but I can appreciate that for someone who doesn't do this on a daily basis, that kind of parsing that out can be difficult.
Yeah, I guess it's maybe we're overdue for our periodic refresher on this topic for whatever new listeners we've accumulated since the last time we discussed this topic. A lipid is just a fancy chemistry term for a particular kind of fatty molecule that doesn't really dissolve in water. And so any kind of lipid, what we'll call species, which there's a whole bunch of different lipids that we have in our body and our blood that have a variety of biological functions, they can't dissolve in water. Since we're mostly water, they need to get carried around on carrier proteins, and we call these lipoproteins. And these lipoproteins are classified based on their density, and their density is determined by their cargo, what kind of things they carry, how much protein, how much lipid, etc. And so that's where you hear terms like high density lipoprotein, or HDL. That's one of the measurements that you'll see on the lipid panels, that HDL cholesterol measurement, or low density lipoprotein, an LDL cholesterol measurement. And there's all sorts of other lipoproteins and subspecies that all carry all sorts of different things around our body. And so the lipoproteins are the things that we really tend to care the most about from a clinical standpoint, but they're not the same thing as cholesterol itself. Cholesterol is one of the things that can be carried on these lipoproteins, and it can get problematic when a lipoprotein like an LDL lipoprotein, which tend to be quite tiny and tend to hang around in our bloodstream for a while, when those tiny lipoproteins get into the walls of our blood vessels and deposit their cargo, and that can lead to an inflammatory immune kind of reaction that can progressively over time lead to the development of plaque, which can then lead to downstream consequences depending on where it is in the body. The blood vessels of your brain, your heart, your legs, your, you know, kidneys, et cetera, can all lead to different types of consequences. And so when we measure these things on routine blood tests, like a lipid panel, as I mentioned, you'll get a test result that shows you a HDL cholesterol, the amount of cholesterol being carried on HDL lipoproteins, then LDL cholesterol, the amount of cholesterol being carried on LDL lipoproteins. You'll get a triglyceride measurement, total cholesterol, et cetera. And so that's something that your doctor will look at, you might look at and try to interpret. And off of that standard lipid panel, the best correlate for your risk, insofar as that is your kind of chronic level of exposure to these lipoproteins, is to take the total cholesterol measurement and to subtract the HDL number out of it. And by doing that, you get a marker called non-HDL cholesterol. There are more advanced, fancier measurements that we can do. Some folks who have been listening to us for a while may have heard of things like an ApoB measurement, which is also another way to get at a similar kind of risk variable here as it relates to cardiovascular disease. And so fundamentally, the total amount of exposure that your cardiovascular system has to these particular lipoproteins, these ones that have ApoB on them, the ones that we can approximate by doing that simple calculation of total cholesterol minus HDL cholesterol, the total amount of exposure that your body sees to that in the blood over the course of your lifetime is one of the strongest kind of predictors of your heart disease risk. Again, other things can augment that risk further. If you have long-term high blood pressure, if you have long-term diabetes and high blood sugar, if you smoke, all of these things can augment, further increase your risk, or if those look like they're in good shape and you don't smoke, can serve to mitigate your risk. And so this is one of the kind of core set of risk factors relating to cardiovascular disease. So the consequence, the logical result of this is that insofar as we want to manage this risk factor as strongly as we can, you would want that non-HDL cholesterol or that ApoB measurement to be, you would prefer it to be lower rather than higher, and you would prefer it to stay low for longer across your lifespan. That's the simplest distillation that I can give of this. There are few situations where I can say that I really recommend this person achieve a higher ApoB level or a higher non-HDL cholesterol measurement. And there may be some who are listening who have heard some evidence or who might knee-jerk and say, well, I read this study that shows that people with higher LDL levels or things like that live longer. And that's a misinterpretation of that literature. I won't go into the great detail on that here. We have an excellent article on cholesterol on our website that actually specifically talks about that topic and lays out the evidence for anyone whose mind is actually open to potentially changing on that topic. So just kind of to summarize, you'll get that lipid panel if you want to do a simple calculation, the total minus HDL, or check an ApoB level. Either way, you would in almost every situation as it relates to your cardiovascular risk, prefer that number to be lower for longer rather than higher over that period of time.
Yeah. And, you're going to get people who say, oh, I switched to the carnivore diet or I switched to a ketogenic diet or whatever. And my, non-HDL cholesterol jumped up to whatever, some higher number. Right. And they've been doing it for a year or 2 years, 3 years, even 5 years. Right. And they're like, hey, look at me, no heart problems. And it's like, well, this is all a probability thing. Yeah. And so as time goes on, the probability continues to increase that you will have heart disease because of this atherogenic load, from the non-HDL cholesterol, from the ApoB containing elements in the blood. And so if you got to choose, do I want this excess exposure or not? You would say no. I mean, that's the logical conclusion. It doesn't mean that everybody with high sort of, atherogenic load is, definitively going to have heart disease. That's not the way human biology works, right? But as far as predicting who's at risk and who's likely to benefit from, reducing exposure, I mean, that's just how it goes. It's not like everybody who smokes doesn't get lung cancer. It doesn't mean that smoking doesn't cause lung cancer. Pretty confident that that's the case,
Yeah, and I can see scenarios where somebody might have obesity and insulin resistance and diabetes, and they might radically overhaul their diet and go on carnivore, for example, and as a result, lose, 20% of their body weight and improve their blood sugar, improve their insulin resistance, get their waist measurement down into healthy ranges. Yet, maybe through that process, as a result of the foods that they were eating before and what they shifted to, maybe their lipids do start to look a bit worse. And so they might, come back and say, well, what do you say? What do you say to that? I'm like, well, it's phenomenal that you achieved the weight loss and improved the insulin resistance, blood sugar, all that is doing you huge, huge, huge favors, maybe even bigger favors, as far as reducing your heart disease risk in comparison to the blood cholesterol increases. Yet, the same thing would apply where if I had to choose between having the higher blood lipid levels in that end state that you've achieved of relative leanness, if I could choose between them being higher versus lower, I would choose them to be lower because that's another risk variable that is still impacting your risk. And there are ways to do that. You don't necessarily need to live with chronically high blood lipid levels. There are lots of ways to manage that from a diet, lifestyle, and pharmacologic or medication lens so that you don't have to necessarily accept that risk. You don't win a prize for accepting that risk long-term if you choose to eat in a particular way.
Yeah, if you would have done the same sort of achieved the same level of body fat loss and weight management and everything else with a plant-based diet, Mediterranean diet, DASH diet, anything like that, you'd likely be better. That's kind of what we're saying here. So, all right. So that's the background on LDL and atherogenic load and heart disease and kind of why this paper was important to discuss. But we're investigating the role of basically exercise and diet on that variable. And so what is currently known about the effects of exercise and diet on this atherogenic load, specifically with respect to LDL? Now, no secret, a lot of research shows that both exercise and dietary modification can significantly affect lipid profiles. We alluded to that earlier. If you go to a high fat carnivore type diet, particularly with high levels of saturated fat, we know that that can deleterious affect people's lipid levels, just like going to a plant-based diet or any even an energy restricted diet. Most of the time will lower the sort of atherogenic load. Dietary factors influence blood lipoprotein levels. There's no question about that, particularly modifying the dietary fat source, as well as both the calorie and fiber intakes can all help reduce blood lipid levels, thereby modifying cardiovascular risk. So specifically, replacing saturated fat, specifically from animal sources, with unsaturated sources, that tends to reduce this atherogenic load. Losing weight via calorie restriction also tends to reduce atherogenic load. Increasing dietary fiber intake, that reduces atherogenic load. Now, the response of individuals to these dietary manipulations varies greatly, but it tends to be pretty modest on average as far as the amount of reduction in this atherogenic load. The range on average tends to center around about 10%, although this can, again, vary wildly. If somebody loses a lot of weight, for example, or they had a very, very poor dietary pattern previously and that changes markedly, you can see a much bigger change. But generally speaking, if somebody is likely to benefit from, for example, a statin medication, a PCSK9 inhibitor, or combination therapy, because their current atherogenic load is so high, it's unlikely that dietary change alone is going to get somebody to the sort of optimal range. Does that strike you as something inflammatory, Dr. Baraki, or are you on board with that?
I wouldn't say it's inflammatory. I think that this is a scenario where, similar to the dementia conversation earlier, not all high blood lipids are the same. It's that you're kind of seeing a snapshot of the end state, but you don't necessarily know how the person got there. And how they got there matters, because it also impacts what types of interventions they might need to get out of that situation. So if somebody at baseline, when they were lean and healthy, maybe earlier in their life, their blood cholesterol levels looked good, but over time they gained some weight, developed insulin resistance, diabetes, their blood lipids looked worse and worse, maybe they don't have the healthiest dietary composition, somebody in that situation may well actually have a pretty substantial response to improving their body composition, exchanging out some food substitutions, things like that. Whereas on the other hand, somebody whose elevated blood cholesterol levels are more genetically driven, that's a situation where you can almost do whatever you want from a dietary standpoint, and you're probably not going to have a massive impact on it. And this is the same thing for a lot of other factors as well, right? So high blood pressure, you're just measuring the end blood pressure result, that you don't know how they got there. Somebody who develops high blood pressure in the setting of insulin resistance and obesity and things like that, very potent effects of a bit of weight loss in that situation. Alternatively, you take somebody who has high blood pressure due to renal artery stenosis. I don't care what your weight is. I mean, I do care, but it doesn't matter what your weight is. Your kidneys are necessarily driving that high blood pressure. And until you fix that, it's not going to get better. So when you lump all sorts of patients in and look at what are the effect of this, it can get a little bit muted. And so that's why it kind of matters how you got there. And as a result of that, overall, what's the point of saying all this is, for most people with high blood lipid levels, with high blood pressure levels, it's certainly worth attempting intensive lifestyle things like these dietary substitutions and exercise in case you're the lucky person who's going to benefit a ton. But I've had patients that I've consulted with who've gone hard on the lifestyle stuff, right? They've tried to do everything in line with best evidence, with what we'd recommend, et cetera. And then we recheck their blood lipids and they've barely budged. And it's like, okay, well, your waist measurement has come down 7 inches and your lipids didn't budge. I feel far more confident now that this is heavily genetically mediated, especially if you tell me that all my parents and grandparents had cholesterol issues or had heart attacks by the time they were 60 or something like that, in which case the conversation about what we do changes much earlier in the course. So that's kind of my thought on this modest effect of 10%. Is it's unsurprising to me if you lump a bunch of people in who got there maybe by different means, a mix of some genetics, some lifestyle, that the result of these interventions might look modest. Whereas if we could somehow isolate out the people who didn't have any kind of genetic, you know, influence here or anything else, then I suspect the impact would be greater. And among those who had the more genetically driven stuff, the effect would be a lot smaller.
Yeah. Yeah. I would predict that if you could do that, if you could parse people in advance, although it'd be difficult to know in advance, like, you know, which one's which, you would likely see a bigger effect to the extent it results in sort of optimal, sort of lipid lowering. That's another question, but that's more, you're going to have to draw a line in the sand. Well, what is optimal? Is it just less than 100, for example, for LDL, or is it more aggressive than that? And that kind of depends on other factors. So for another podcast, but yeah generally speaking, there are both direct and indirect effects of dietary pattern change on people's blood cholesterol levels. So not only through weight loss, but also through just dietary pattern change in general. Exercise is much of the same way. So exercise enhances the uptake and utilization of free fatty acids from the blood by active skeletal muscles. Yeah, your muscles use fat, right? And it consequently reduces the LDL cholesterol, triglycerides, and raises H. Pretty good effects from exercise, but generally speaking, smaller than dietary pattern changes, yes, which are generally speaking smaller than medication induced changes. As far as like what types of exercise are best, a really cool new meta-analysis came out from SMART in January of 2025. I've linked that in the description below. Yes, combined resistance training and aerobic training are better than one or the other. And there's a dose-dependent relationship in sort of weekly training volume. So the more training volume that people do, generally speaking, the bigger reduction they're going to see. Again, it tends to be modest overall, but if you were wondering like, well, should I exercise more or less as far as health benefits go? Generally speaking, if you can tolerate it physiologically, meaning that, you know, you are sort of well suited to the sort of training demands. We think that more training generally is better and that you should do both lifting and cardio. Okay. With all of that prelude out of the way, the purpose of this study was to see if there was an optimal range of calorie restriction for improving blood lipid profiles in those with high blood cholesterol. So this particular study took 64 subjects, all with high cholesterol levels, and they were insufficiently active, so not really meeting the current activity guidelines. They measured their resting energy expenditure, and they also measured their physical activity using some different clinical analytic tools. And they split them up into four different groups. Based on the sort of dietary pattern they wanted to put people on, or dietary sort of restriction. So during this experiment, all of the subjects got three meals per day that were prepared by the research group. And so effectively, they were only to eat those meals, and they were weighed on a regular basis to make sure that people weren't deviating from that sort of dietary plan. And most of the individuals ate the meals on site, and the researchers actually watched to make sure that they finished all their meals. So to the extent that you're doing a sort of study where dietary manipulation is like part of the study design, this is pretty decent design. The study lasted for 4 weeks. During this four-week period, all of the individuals did an hour of cardio 5 times per week. And the title of the study kind of shows you like what intensity that the cardio was at. So they call it fat max intensity, which is somewhere in that 60 to 75% of max heart rate, like the quote fat burning zone. So it was distinctly aerobic. Okay. And they actually tried to measure this before the study started. I'll leave out the details there because I think that's mostly shenanigans as far as like, oh, this is the optimal fat burning zone, but that's what they did. 5 hours of cardio a week. And then they basically fed them a very specific amount of calories. So four groups that the subjects were split up into, one just got their resting energy expenditure, their basal metabolic rate level of calories. So that's a big deficit. Then the second group got their resting energy expenditure, so resting basal metabolic rate, plus about a third of the calories that they burned during exercise. The third group, again, got their basal metabolic rate in calories, plus about two-thirds of the amount of calories they burned during exercise. And then the final group, the fourth group, got their basal metabolic rate in calories, plus 100% of the calories that they burned. So theoretically, that group should have been at maintenance. Okay. As far as the results go, so let's start with weight loss. The group just getting their basal metabolic rate in calories on a big deficit, well, they lost on average of 6.3 kilos in 4 weeks, which is
remarkable. Yeah.
Remarkable indeed. You compare that to the group who got, was that maintenance, right? Well, they lost 4.39 kilos on average. The math ain't math in there because if they were truly at maintenance, then they shouldn't have lost any weight. So unclear as to, you know, what the researchers did. They didn't actually comment on that at all in the paper. Like, oh yeah, look, the group that we had, you know, eating maintenance actually lost 4 kilos. So kind of interesting there. But there was a dose-dependent relationship in deficit, calorie deficit, and weight loss. The bigger the deficit, the more weight was lost, just exactly as you would predict. As far as body composition goes, and this is going to be important, so try to remember this if you're listening at home, the group just getting their basal metabolic rate in calories, well, they lost about 2.25 kilos of fat-free mass and about 4.6 kilos of fat mass, whereas the maintenance group lost about 1 kilogram of fat-free mass and about 3 kilograms of fat mass. So I just picked the two most disparate groups so you can get a lay of the land. But again, dose dependent. In general, the bigger the deficit, the more weight was lost, and the more of that tended to be fat mass, but there still was additional lean mass loss. Should also say they weren't measuring actual, like, you know, actual skeletal muscle. This is just anything that's not fat. So that includes water, for example, and muscle glycogen, other stuff, or other sort of stuff. As far as the actual risk factors for heart disease, let's start with total cholesterol. Compared with the baseline levels of total cholesterol, all of the groups significantly decreased their total cholesterol after 4 weeks. There was no significant change in HDL in all four groups. There was also no significant change in serum ApoA1. It's another sort of marker for these various proteins carried on the lipoproteins that carry around the cholesterol. As far as LDL and apolipoprotein B, these sort of measurements of atherogenic load, they went down in all groups except for the maintenance group. And the amount of reduction in LDL and apolipoprotein B was proportional to the calorie restriction. So, of the people included in this study, in the group that was at just their basal metabolic rate of calorie intake, so the big, big deficit, 85% of participants at the end of 4 weeks basically had lost so much LDL and apolipoprotein B that they were no longer in the inclusion criteria for the study.
I think a simple way to translate that from, like, science speak is that the people who had the most weight loss were the most likely to put their kind of high cholesterol into remission, or to, like, cure their high cholesterol, so to speak, since that was the criteria to get into the study that you mentioned. 85% of those who lost the most weight cured their high cholesterol, whereas those who lost a bit less were a little bit less likely, who lost less than that were a little bit less likely than that, and those who lost the least weight were the least likely to cure or put their blood high cholesterol into remission or to cure it.
Yep. Yep, exactly. And they saw that as well for total cholesterol levels, that same sort of breakdown, that the more weight that people lost, the higher likelihood they were to put their high cholesterol into remission. And again, this was only a 4-week study, so pretty impressive, actually. All right, so let's move on to interpretation here. Again, I think you summarized it perfectly that, hey, look, the more weight that people lost, the better, you know, their high cholesterol went into remission. So, you know, what's the interpretation? Is it just that? Well, curiously, the authors said that, look, man, we're not looking for, like, max weight loss here to get max reduction in cardiovascular risk factors, because you can lose too much lean body mass. It goes back to the same stupid, and I'm not calling the researchers stupid, but to me, the concern over lean body mass loss in individuals with, whether it's insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, people at high risk of heart disease, et cetera, that's a red herring. Like, why are we focusing on this outside of those that are, like, currently suffering or at high risk of, like, frailty, right? Or, like, sarcopenia, for example. It's like individuals that are carrying excess body fat tend to carry high levels of lean body mass, certainly higher than their lean counterparts, all else being equal. So, like, the idea that we're worried about losing more lean mass, I got to have a really good reason to care about that, whether it's performance oriented, but again, that's really not what we're talking about here, or somebody who's at risk of losing so much lean mass that they're now sarcopenic, right? So in this particular study, those getting the most severe restriction in calories, just receiving their basal metabolic rate in calories, well, they lost 2.25 kilos of fat-free mass and 4.6 kilos of fat mass. If we compare that to just the maintenance group, that group almost lost a kilo of fat-free mass. Again, that's not muscle. That's, you know, we're talking about a kilo difference here. It's probably water in this 1 month, you know, 4 week study, right? And even if it was pure, you know, unadulterated muscular protein, who cares? It's just a kilo, right? That kilo is relatively unimportant with respect to like risk of virtually any disease I can think of in this particular group. So why do you think these authors were like, hey, look, maybe not max calorie restriction, maybe let's do it at, you know, 66% or something like that. Let's temper it a little bit. Why do you think they came to that sort of conclusion, Dr. Baraki? And do you agree with it?
Yeah, I'm in agreement with what you stated here more so than with the authors. I don't love the focus on fat-free mass as this just like absolutely crucial outcome in this context, because like you said, it's not all muscle mass. And even if it was muscle mass, that is the loss of a slight amount of muscle mass in this context is likely to be less deleterious to them that compared with the benefit of putting your high blood lipids into remission, curing that condition altogether, especially because if you can, you know, then maintain that improvement in your blood lipids, you can lift some weights and you can build it, you know, you can relatively easily in, because this is not like this was taking super highly trained. This is not taking Mr. Olympia bodybuilders who need to train for, you know, 6 months to, you know, achieve a couple grams of new muscle on them. These are people who are likely to respond readily to some strength training. So I would just rewrite their conclusion to say more weight loss tends to be more effective at curing high blood cholesterol levels. And to the extent that there is a quote unquote adverse effect of lean body mass loss, we recommend intensive resistance training to mitigate, reduce that, or potentially even have people who are less trained can actually gain lean body mass despite their weight loss in this context.
Yeah. Yeah. If they were super concerned with that, one, why no resistance training? Two, yeah, why no, there's no discussion on dietary protein intake? And then three, no like risk benefit analysis with respect to like, okay, they lost a little bit of muscle mass or lean mass. We don't know that it's muscle mass, but our concern is for that. It's like, if you were that concerned, I feel like your study design would have been different and so would your conclusions. So clearly better outcomes with more weight loss here, which is exactly what we would have predicted. I'm unconcerned with the additional loss of lean mass. And I think if you asked most people, you're like, hey, look, man, if we take this more intensive sort of lifestyle intervention, right, and you just do it and you make it there, you know, to the end, and you lose enough weight that where your cholesterol, it's now optimized. You might lose a kilo more of muscle, but you don't have to take statins. You don't have to take any other sort of medication to like sort of get optimized, quote unquote. I think most people would pick that option, you know, just generally speaking. So, all right, let's wrap this up. Globally, heart disease is the most common cause of death. And we know that established risk factors for heart disease include high blood pressure, diabetes, and blood cholesterol levels, among others. Now, each of these risk factors increase the risk of heart disease with increased exposure, where exposure is related to both the severity and the duration of exposure. Exercise and diet improve these risk factors through a number of different effects, some relating to weight and fat loss, and others being independent of body mass changes. For all individuals, we recommend eating a health-promoting dietary pattern, i.e. one that focuses on minimally processed foods, lean proteins, lots of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, and other fiber-containing foods, while avoiding foods with added sugar and those with saturated fats from animals. We also recommend exercise to include both lifting weights and conditioning to complement dietary changes when it comes to these established risk factors for heart disease. For individuals with excess body fat who are open to it, we recommend pursuing weight loss with lifestyle, medications, and/or surgery as needed to optimize their health trajectory. Generally speaking, more fat loss is associated with greater improvement in these risk factors. Dr. Baraki, anything you want to add to Jordan's corner that we just put there at the end of this research paper?
No, I'm on board. Uncontroversial, at least in this corner of the internet.
Tepid takes here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. We're here with Dr. Austin Baraki, February 2025 research review. All right, we're going to talk about running injuries. Now, Austin, I know you've been running recently. Have you suffered a running-related injury as of
late? Fortunately, I can't say I have. I think that that's just been due to, in general, being reasonably well conditioned and managing my intensities and training volume, similar to the way we advise, you know, managing injury risk in the strength training realm, instead of using purely RPE, been using a fair amount of like combination RPE and heart rate training, kind of oriented targets to adjust intensity day to day. And it's just a familiar style of training to me from my days in the pool. So I know how to do this.
So this study that we're going to talk about is called Using Self-Reported Training Characteristics to Better Understand Who is More Likely to Sustain Running-Related Injuries Than Others, the Garmin Run Safe Running Health Study. You know, an acronym would have been pretty good.
They tried. Like, they just baked an acronym into their longer title.
Yeah, exactly. So this is by Abrahamson his research group. Is published in the Scandinavian Journal of Medicine and Science and Sports, December 2024. And the purpose of this study was to use self-reported baseline data on running experience, weekly running frequency, and greatest running distance in 1 week. And the running program that people used to investigate if certain adult runners were more likely to sustain a running-related injury than others. So as a little bit of background here, we all know that physical inactivity is a major problem worldwide with a number of important consequences. According to the World Health Organization, it represents the fourth leading risk factor for death worldwide behind high blood pressure, tobacco use, and elevated blood sugar. And there have been major initiatives by national and international health organizations to increase participation in exercise in order to reduce the risk of disease and premature death. However, there are many real and perceived barriers to increasing participation in physical activity. These include older age, high body mass index, low levels of education, poor perception of health, lack of enjoyment, low self-efficacy, lack of time, low income, and many others. Perceived risk of injury also may represent a significant barrier to physical activity participation, because nearly 40% of healthy individuals agree that they'd increase physical activity if they were not afraid of injury. Now, despite the insinuation that most people have that resistance training may be a risky proposition, lifting weights is actually one of the safer types of exercise available, with an average injury rate of about 1 to 4 injuries per 1,000 participation hours for all different types of resistance training modalities. So this suggests that, you know, bodybuilding, powerlifting, weightlifting, and CrossFit are comparable to other non-contact sports and recreational activities. So like track and field, for example, has an injury rate of about 3.6 injuries per 1,000 participation hours, whereas walking and cycling have injury risks of 0.19 to 1.2 and 0.5 to 2 injuries per 1,000 participation hours, depending on study methodology. So in this study, we're going to see like, well, look, are there any predictors of running-related injuries, and just how high was the injury rate in these runners anyway? So the study took adult runners from all around the world that used a Garmin wearable device while tracking their training, and they were recruited for the study. This is in the second half of 2019. Average length of follow-up was about 18 months, and at baseline, when they were recruited into the study, they filled out a questionnaire, and the main exposure or sort of variables of interest were running experience in years, greatest running distance in 1 week, running frequency, so how often they ran per week, and then whether or not they followed a structured running program. So every Sunday, a weekly questionnaire was sent to these individuals asking, in the past week, have you had a musculoskeletal injury, or have you experienced a problem to the muscles, tendons, or bones that are fully or partly caused by running? And so an injury was defined as something painful and irritating that led to a reduction in running activity, whereas a problem was defined as less severe than an injury, causing pain and irritation, yet allowing the runners to maintain their habitual running activity. It's actually a pretty good definition for injury and problem. Do you have any major issues with that, Dr. Baraki?
No, I like it.
Yeah. Compared to some studies that actually investigate injury risk, like I'm pumped that they actually defined what it was. And then two, that seems like a pretty reasonable definition. I also like the differentiation into like what a problem was, because I think it's going to sound a weird soundbite, but I think you and I have had more problems than injuries over the years. And I wish that would like was a more accepted sort of, you know, thing when people say, oh, I'm injured. I'm like, is it really an injury or is it more of a problem?
I think we would rarely have described ourselves as being injured, even when you could maybe make an argument that we were, just like maybe a mental stubbornness on our own part. And we're like, I just got this ache. It's kind of annoying, but I'm dealing with it, whatever the case is. Call it a problem instead of an injury.
I got a problem, man.
Yeah, the way you self-identify it might make a difference for you psychologically in navigating it.
Yeah, totally. All right. So this study ended up using 7,391 runners. About 3/4 of them were men. As far as the experience of the runners, about 1/4 of them had been running for 5 to 10 years. About another 1/4 had been running for 10 to 20 years. 20% approximately had been running for 20 to 40 years of running experience. Yeah. A lot of experienced runners, and actually most of the data they've had on running experience and how that correlated to injuries from before, like capped running experience at 10 years or more. So this is a little more granular than some of the previous data. The average 5K time, well, about 2/3 of the included sample, they were running 5Ks in the 20 to 29 minute range. So, you know, we're not talking about Olympic level, you know, athletes here, but also not necessarily just like super recreational folks. So people are actually doing some running. 3/4 of folks using this Garmin wearable were following a structured running program, which is actually pretty impressive. If we sampled the Barbell Medicine app users, I suspect that we'd have an even higher percentage rate of people that were following a structured program. At least I hope.
The app definitely would be a selection filter for that type of person. Yeah.
Yeah. As far as total injuries that were recorded, 3,726 injuries were recorded. So about half of all individuals sustained at least one related injury during this 18-month follow-up. And they also separated this out based on sort of running distance. So at once people hit 1,000 kilometers in this follow-up period of total running distance, about 57% had at least one running related injury. So from all of this and all the data they collected, they came up with the following risk factors. So most injuries occurred in those with the lowest training frequency and shortest weekly distance. So for example, people running one time per week or less than 15 kilometers per week, those had the highest amount of injuries, not only as a group, but also like per 1,000 kilometers sort of completed. The lowest injury rate was in those running with the highest frequency, so 7 times per week, and the highest mileage, which was 105 kilometers per week or more. To me, maybe that's a little survivorship bias. It's like, look, if you were going to get injured, you would never make it into that group,
yep.
Right? Like, So, you know,
I think it's not exclusively that. There's a mix. I mean, both you and I have worked with people, we've coached people who seem to be, you know, maybe a little bit more injury prone. They experience aches and pains and issues more often. And then some people who are just, you know, steel. They like, you can throw whatever at them and they like will not break. And so I think it's probably a combination. You have some freaks who are just very injury resistant through genetics, through luck, whatever the case is, combined with the fact that those who are more susceptible are going to get weeded out before they ever make it to that level of training.
Yeah. Yeah. There was also a U-shaped relationship between running experience and injuries, where those with 10 to 20 years of experience had the lowest rate of injuries, and those that had 20 to 40 and less than 1 year had the highest injury rates. The less than 1 year makes perfect sense to me. Just, you know, with that level of experience, it is more likely that you're going to do too much too quickly. You just have no real base to pull from. The 20 to 40 years was more interesting to me, because I'm like, okay, so when did these people start running? Like, was age actually like a, you know, predictor? They didn't comment on that at all, but I would have liked to see like the average age in that group, just to see like, because that's what most people, I feel like, are going to jump to immediately, that conclusion. Like, oh, well, they must have been older and that was the injury risk. But I'd be more curious to know if that were true.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that there's something to be said for just cumulative exposure or the amount of time you spend doing an activity. If there is some percentage risk associated per unit time, then the more time you do it, like your cumulative risk of it, the longer you do something, the more likely at some point you're going to have experienced it. And that may be part of it. But yeah, it's quite surprising to me that age was not pulled out of this data set. Seems like it would be a very straightforward thing to do, but
yeah,
maybe
like
not.
They certainly recorded it, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Yeah. As far as frequency goes as a risk factor, 72% in those running one time per week had an injury, whereas 25% in those running 7 times per week had an injury, suggesting that those with the most infrequent exposure to this maybe had a higher injury risk. But I think that is also like confounded by how much people are running, how long they've been running, and like, you know, just their experience overall. Because most experienced runners are going to run more than once per week, right? And so it just, to me, that seems just like another sort of supporting factor that, like, yeah, in general, inexperienced runners and those running less are probably going to be at high risk for injury during this particular time period, which was, again, 18 months on average for follow-up.
Yeah, agree.
Yeah. Distance, this was interesting. So at the 1,000 kilometer of like cumulative distance mark, 69% of those who were averaging 15 kilometers per week or less had a running related injury, whereas 38% of those running 105 kilometers per week experienced an injury by the 1,000 kilometer mark. So time-wise, it's going to take those people doing less than 15 kilometers per week to, you know, it's going to take them longer to get to that first sort of running related injury compared to if they were running, you know, 105 kilometers per week. But it seems like, yeah, higher injury risk. Dr. Baraki, if you had to speculate on that, do you think this is more of just like a, you know, look, just less preparation because there's no way that you could run 105 kilometers per week on average unless you were really, really prepared and really like kind of experienced in running?
Yeah, a lot of variables, including some of the survivorship bias may well be coming through here as well. So I think without more granular data, I think it's almost not worthwhile to speculate a ton on this because the main way I'm thinking about this, I guess, is like as a clinician, which we'll come to in the interpretation period, where it's like, if I were trying to get somebody started with running, or if I was managing, you know, a runner who was dealing with frequent injuries, what would I do with all of this information, which I think we're going to get to here shortly, which is where my mind's been throughout this, this conversation.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then finally, obviously, just as predicted, those who are on a running plan had less injuries than those who are not following a plan, which, yeah, kind of something we would predict. So, all right, let's interpret this. You know, my interpretation, I assume, is going to be similar to yours. Generally speaking, all effective exercise has the potential for risk, though generally the benefit is greater than the risk for most forms of exercise. The injury risk from running, like other forms of exercise, is mostly related to training load, which includes how much someone's exercising and how often, how hard those bouts of exercise are, and how different the sort of demands are than what they're habitually used to doing. So how prepared are they for these types of exercise? And so overall, load management is super important. It likely improves with experience. As people like go on in their sort of training career, they're more attuned to not only what their body is doing, but what they can handle and what they can't handle. So it'd be very unlikely for an experienced trainee to do something very, let's call it not smart. Because again, they've been doing it for a long enough time where they can kind of sense like, this is too much, or this is not enough, or and everything in between just kind of comes with the territory. So I think there's also some level of survivorship bias here as well. Because again, the people that you know, got injured and dropped out and never quite made it to, you know, getting a Garmin wearable. Well, we're not capturing any of them, for example. And further, the people who maybe got the Garmin and never made it to this high frequency of running, high mileage. Again, there's some, you know, other factors at play here besides just training load. But I just lump those all together and call it luck on some level.
Right? Yeah, like, exactly.
It's just something else going on. So to the extent we can control stuff, training load's probably the stuff where I would spend most of my time, because I don't know that we can modify your luck, but we can definitely tilt things in your favor by making sure that the training load that's being administered is well suited to you, the individual, and the progression of that training load over time matches your sort of adaptation rate, recovery rate, and resources that you have available to you.
Yeah, well, let's give some more practical, instead of kind of being more in the clouds with, managing load. If you were to have a new client or trainee who wanted to introduce running, or perhaps that might be you yourself, even though you're very well trained otherwise, let's say you were less trained otherwise, a relatively untrained person who wanted to get into this, what would be your mental approach towards organizing their training to mitigate their injury risk? Because nobody wants to experience injury, especially early on in their training career.
This is a good question. So like how to do load management for somebody who is new to a particular type of exercise, in this case, cardio. So you want to know who the person is and what they want to do. And you know, who the person is their current level of fitness, their current resources, right? And their current preferences. In this case, they clearly prefer running, if that's what we're talking about. And so that's part of what they want to do. But even more within that is, are they just trying to start running because they feel like they should be able to run? That's like my personal thing. Like it's the only reason I do any sort of running. Or is there like a goal where they want to run a marathon, half marathon, 10K, or a particular time in their mile? So those things are important to sort of plan the training. And, you know, it's programming 101. So let's start with somebody who's not currently doing any sort of conditioning and go from there, and we'll cover some additional use cases as we go along. So the first benchmark, you know, that we're looking to get this person to is to complete the minimum physical activity guidelines for adults, which is 150 minutes per week of moderate to vigorous physical activity, or 75 minutes at a minimum, vigorous intensity conditioning, or some combination of the two, right? So you guys have heard us talk about the physical activity guidelines. That's what we're talking about from a conditioning standpoint. So with a person who's not currently doing any sort of conditioning, I typically start them somewhere between 20 to 30 minutes of conditioning per session, three times per week. They can do that after lifting. They can do it on separate days. Obviously, I want people doing both lifting and conditioning. So whatever works for their schedule, that's all good. But yeah, about 20 to 30 minutes per session, three times per week. For somebody interested in running, if that's their preference, I'll usually start them, you know, once to twice per week. So of the three times per week, they can do it once or twice. And that's usually a run walk. And I give them heart rate limits. So typically somewhere between 60 to 70% of their max heart rate. That's as high as they can go. Otherwise, they're walking. And I also combine that with the subjective feelings of exertion, so RPE. So it should feel like RPE 3 to 5. And if you want to call that zone one to the beginning stages of zone two, middle zone two, that's all fine. Again, these are kind of squishy zones, so no real hard lines in the sand there. But that's typically how I start people out. 20 to 30 minutes a session, three times per week. Of that, one to two sessions can be running if it's a run walk. And so, yeah, put a heart rate cap on it, put an RPE cap on it. And then if they kind of exceed that, then they should start walking. I do prefer some variety here. So that's why I'm limiting this sort of run walk exposure to once to twice per week. I want to prevent overuse injuries, and I want to develop this broad base of fitness. So that can't just be a single modality where somebody has proficiency in, so like running. So I want people to do some running slash jogging if they want to do that, some cycling, some erging on a rower or ski erg. Swimming is something that people can do. So it really just depends on the person, their goals. You know, somebody who's lifting focused, I'd probably avoid swimming. And somebody with no running background, I don't know that running would be my preferred modality if that person was super interested in strength in the short to medium term. But if this is all just about general health promotion and we're not really worried about 1RM performance in the next, you know, few weeks, then I think this is a perfectly fine place to start. So that's where we started, 20 to 30 minutes a session, three times per week. Of that, running or walking is once to twice per week. And then we're going to progress from there. So first thing is the duration, because we want to get to that first benchmark, which is the, you know, physical activity guidelines, minimum about 150 minutes per week of moderate to vigorous physical activity. So week over week, I tend to increase duration of these sort of conditioning efforts by about 10%. So, you know, an extra five to 10 minutes per session is kind of what I'm looking at to get to that 150 minute mark per week. And if logistics sort of reduce somebody's ability to do that, they're like, look, I can do 20 or 30 minutes after you know, lifting session, for example, but I can't do longer than that because I got to go. That's totally fine. We can do another day. We can split up the workouts, whatever works for somebody's schedule. Another form of progression that I like to do in addition to increasing the duration to get to that 150 minute mark per week is exposing them to different intensities. So in the beginning, it's pretty much all zone one, zone two. I don't really get into that sort of zone three tempo work or threshold work, zone four, and, you know, maximal work zone five when people are just starting out. Although, to be clear, I don't know that any of the zone stuff matters when people are just doing a relatively low volume of conditioning. But if I get the chance to program for people, I want to do a good job at it. And I want to, you know, give them some specifics here. So as people progress, as we're starting to add volume, you know, week over week, probably after around week four or five, you know, we're starting to get closer to those guideline minimums. At that point, I start to expand the sort of exposure to different intensities. I don't do any sort of sprint interval training usually for folks unless they have a background and they're pretty well conditioned systemically when they're coming in. But for the person who, you know, was currently not doing any conditioning and wanted to start, that's not my prediction that they have a good base of aerobic fitness, for example. So I'll start at this point around week five or week six with some exposure to high intensity interval training, which basically just means stuff above zone two. So we're talking zones three and zone four, mostly aerobic intervals. And they're not all out efforts. They're not maximal efforts. They're RP six, seven, eight type efforts. And so, you know, we're talking about intervals that last from 3 to 7 minutes, something like that, with some either lighter or easier work periods in between. So lower intensity work periods in between the interval efforts, just trying to expose people to these different sort of intensities. Overall, majority of the stuff should be low and slow, you know, zone one, zone two stuff, but you can even do intervals within zone one and zone two. Do that for a lot of individuals that have some respiratory limitations or prefer that sort of approach rather than just, you know, continuous aerobic training. And yeah, some exposure to these faster and shorter efforts, about 20% of the total training volume. So of the 150 minute per week sort of minimum that we're trying to work towards, about 120 minutes of that should be, you know, low and slow. And then, you know, about 30 minutes can be a little bit faster and some interval type efforts. That's kind of the way I tend to fractionate that out. As we're increasing the volume here and expanding this sort of different exposure to different intensities, people will tend to increase their frequency of conditioning to get all of that volume in. And so I tend to cap running in folks who are focused on lifting performance and or just running for sort of general fitness, not any running specific goal. I tend to cap running at about 2 to 3 times per week. Again, just to make sure that the person's doing a variety of different conditioning types and also not to avoid any sort of overuse type thing. That's pretty much, we have no reason to push the limit on that because we're just training for general fitness. For running specific goals, so like a faster mile, faster 5K, 10K, want to run a marathon, whatever, people will have to run more frequently than that. But again, that's the sort of specialization that we're moving towards as somebody continues to develop their cardiorespiratory fitness. So what we've covered so far is an entry point, you know, 20 to 30 minutes per session, 3 times per week. One or two of those sessions per week should be run walk. And then we're progressing from there to where people can run for longer periods of time at higher intensities once they do some interval work and maybe even more frequently. But it's not that every training session should be running. You know, for most folks, especially if they're not, you know, pretty close to an actual like test of running performance, and that's not important to them at a particular time. After somebody's hit that first sort of benchmark, meeting the current physical activity guidelines for conditioning and lifting, they're doing some running each week because that is their preference. That's all good. What's next? Really, it just depends on a person's goals. I mean, the second benchmark that I'm trying to work people towards is what is the maximum amount of training that they can do, both logistically and physiologically. And because we know there's this dose-dependent relationship between exercise and sort of health promotion and also improvement in performance, that's where we're trying to get people towards. And so the two sort of constraints are logistically, so resources, how much time do they have to exercise, and physiologically, what's their current sort of training tolerance. As far as how running, you know, fits in here and conditioning in general, maybe we'll start there. I think that most people would improve their health trajectory by developing more cardiorespiratory fitness than could be generated by the guideline minimums. So if the guideline minimums are 150 minutes per week, I actually think that aiming for about double of that would be a great sort of reach goal or stretch goal for people looking to improve their health. So health-focused folks, that's probably the trajectory I would take them on. Similarly, for the resistance training elements of the current guidelines, instead of just twice per week, I'd probably be aiming for more than that, 3-4 times per week. And it's not that people have to turn into a bodybuilder or, you know, a marathoner or a professional exerciser. It's just like, if you're asking me what, you know, amount of exercise is going to maximize a health span, it's probably going to be about double the current guidelines. So on the other hand, if somebody's lifting focused, lifting performance focused, so whether it's hypertrophy, strength, or both, I don't know that, you know, going towards double the guidelines for cardio, I don't think that's likely to support that goal. And so people in the middle, if they're like, look, I am focused on my health, but I do really like lifting performance, well, it's kind of a compromise. And this is probably where the interference effect actually starts to come in. It's like when you're trying to do a high amount of high volume of training overall, at some point you run out of resources, right? So anyway, that's second benchmark that I'm trying to get people towards is, look, how much training can I have you do before we really start redlining and kind of outkicking your coverage? With respect to running here, I still prefer variety for general focus on fitness. If somebody has a running specific goal, they're going to have to do more frequency to achieve that increase in volume. And in addition to that, this is the time where people can get even more exposure to different intensities. So this is where I would start programming some sprint intensity training. how I tend to do that is with what I call surges in the middle of like traditional aerobic work. So let's say I had programmed somebody, we're going to run for 40 minutes at mostly zone two. So, you know, your heart rate should be somewhere between 65 to 75% of your max heart rate, RP 4 to 6, somewhere in there. So yeah, it's a 40 minute run at zone two, RP 4 to 6. In the middle of that, I'm going to have them do some surges, which are just, you know, 8 to 10 second kind of all out bursts, followed by a very low intensity period of kind of active rest. So it would be, if someone was running, it would be fast run, you know, 8 to 10 seconds, go hard, and then sort of walk for 50 seconds and do that every minute on the minute for, you know, 8 to 10 minutes, and then finish the run with the remaining time back to zone one, zone two, something like that. That's sort of the initial exposure rather than like a dedicated sprint session. I think for people with shorter sort of running related goals, whether it's mile, 800 meter, 400 meter, you know, things are going to be much different than people with longer running related goals, 5K, 10K marathons. And so one way to conceptually think about this is that there, you should be having some exposure to longer and slower efforts than whatever your running related goal is. And you should also have some exposure to shorter and faster related training efforts than whatever your specific goal is. So if your goal is a mile, you should have some exposure to, you know, training at a 5K pace, 10K pace, etc. So that's longer and slower pace. And then you should have some exposure to efforts that would be akin to your 800 meter or 400 meter pace. That's the way I tend to program, where the majority of that stuff of the programming volume is longer and slower, about 80%, and then 20% of it is faster and shorter. But again, all of this has happened over time. So I'm not doing really sprint interval training until, you know, 2.5-3 months after somebody's kind of built up some tolerance here. And I'm not doing, you know, any sort of like even aerobic intervals until, you know, 6 weeks, 8 weeks into somebody's sort of cardio career, if you will. And they're kind of have already progressed to the physical activity guideline minimums, are doing well with that. And then we can sort of bump up the intensity a little bit. So if I had to summarize this all, let's start low and slow, 20 to 30 minutes per session, 3 times per week, gradually progress from there, maybe a 10% jump in volume week over week until you hit the physical activity guideline minimums. From there, you can add some intensity variety in there so people get exposed to some higher intensity work, not yet sprint stuff. And then as people go on week over week, again, increasing the duration to potentially up to twice the guidelines, be a reasonable goal for health focused folks or people who are focused on conditioning related performance. And then again, at that point, you can start thinking about some sprint intensity training. That's yeah, my quick and dirty, maybe not so quick, you know, sort of load management how to.
Yeah, I think some distillations from that, you have to get in shape before you can do the really hard stuff. And that can take a bit of time and often longer than people want. And so you had mentioned starting out with a frequency of once a week. And I think that's fine if you are already able to run. There are people who are not yet able to do that. And so they might be, you know, doing a fast walk or something like that. And that fast walk, depending on how in shape or not they are, that may already put them into zone one, zone two kind of range. In which case, I would probably having them doing those kind of fast walks more often because it's easier to tolerate to build up some of that fitness. And then as those walks, you know, notice that their heart rate is lower and lower, they're able to go faster at the same heart rate, then we can introduce a once a week run. But again, I'm capping the intensity for sure, keeping them in that low intensity range for a while before we start to extend the duration, before we start to push into the higher zones, before we do any kind of interval work is like a ways off for that population. So using pretty hard heart rate caps is a way that I would do that. Or if you didn't, you want to use a heart rate monitor, like the talk test type tool that we've talked about before. And then aside from the actual running, walking, you know, interval, drill, whatever kind of work you do, I would have them lifting weights in some capacity, involving the lower extreme, involving the legs, involving some calf training, maybe even if they're able to tolerate eventually, depending on where they're starting from, a little bit of some plyometric type stuff, just to the extent that I have control over shoring up some of their, you know, tendons and ligaments and soft tissues in the legs and calves and ankles and some things that can be common problem areas. as well as just introducing some variation to their training, especially if it's somebody who's wanting to train for running on a treadmill where it's going to be kind of monotonic, meaning just doing the same thing repeatedly, versus if somebody's running like where I do in my area. I live like at the top of a hill. There's a lot more variation, ups and downs and turns and corners and terrain, which I view as a benefit compared with, you know, steady in the same exact movement, which would often come with a little bit higher risk of overuse stuff. So yeah, building the base of fitness before pushing into higher intensities at all, and then doing some preparatory work outside of running in the gym with lifting weights, plyos, things like that would be a way that I would kind of get somebody started with this process.
Yeah. It very similar to like lifting weights, right? And you're like, okay, if somebody's not lifting weights, what would you want them to do? And you're like, we're going to pick, you know, some activities that they like, some types of lifts that they like. We're going to have a broad range of rep schemes. So that's going to be different loading. That's the same thing for running. You're going to use a broad range of different intensities. But to get to that point, you have to be able to run. And so like if you had somebody who couldn't currently lift weights, right? You can't say, oh, well, we're going to do some sets of like 5 to 8 and some sets of 8 to 12. You're like, bro, I can't lift. So like, where do I start? And you got to start behind that. And so that in this particular case is more like walking, you know, run, walk, jog, walk. Somebody can't really walk for extended periods of time, which, you know, that could be a thing. Well, maybe it's going to be an elliptical or a bike, you know.
Stationary bike. Great.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Gotta kind of lay that groundwork to get you to a point where you can, you know, actually do the things that you want to do. So, we'll see. Maybe we'll do a follow-up episode on my running prowess. Like, here's how I beat lower extremity compartment syndrome. Follow me for more tips. All right. Well, that is a wrap here on the February 2025 research review on the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. Thanks so much, Dr. Austin Baraki, for joining us on this podcast. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, we'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
Big news, everyone. We just released 2 new training programs. First up, our second generation Strength One program, which is designed for folks who are trying to get stronger on the squat, the bench press, the deadlift, and the overhead press. It includes 4 12-week programs, and users can now pick their own exercises, choose between 3 or 4 day options, and choose to focus on either the bench press or the overhead press, in addition to the squat and the deadlift. The programming has also been overhauled to drive better results based on testing and user feedback. Next, we also launched our second generation Time Crunch program, which is designed for busy professionals, parents, and other on-the-go lifters who want to maximize results without spending hours upon hours in the gym. This one includes 6 12-week programs, ranging from longer workouts that are performed 2 days per week to shorter workouts performed daily and everything in between. No matter what your availability is, we have something for you. Both programs can be done with basic gym equipment like a bar, rack, and weights, but they can also be modified to use more specialized equipment in the gym if you like. Both programs also include a brand new ebook that includes details on the program, training theory, nutrition, supplements, and more. If you previously purchased the first generation of these programs, check your email for instructions on how to upgrade to the latest version. For everyone else who wants to get the most out of their training, head over to barbellmedicine.com and check out these new training programs. Hey everyone, Jordan here from Barbell Medicine. I'll get to the podcast here in just a moment, but I wanted to take a second to plug our Barbell Medicine Plus option in order to help support what we do here on the podcast and beyond. Now, if you hate these ads just as much as we do, you should know that Plus members get ad-free episodes, as well as early access to our podcast, written episode summaries, videos, exclusive training information, access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing here and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus to help us out and get rid of these ads for good. Thanks for your support. Let's head to the podcast.